Well, if you could stick around just a minute, I mean, right now, what was your sitting like?
So I had pretty good I had a pretty good stable constant energy all over by the time you came in. And then it got really strong, but it wasn't waving or anything. And then I know I was
Was it
trained
really
up.
strong, or were you more vividly aware of it?
Well, the same, right? You
It's
know what?
important to make that distinction, though.
Sure. Like when you say you move it up and down, you're not moving it up and down. Your awareness is moving in your, and it makes it feel like it's going. But so that was stable. I know I was, now I'm just going to use the word tranced out for a bit.
What can you say more about what that experience was like?
It's basically that energy is really strong. It's all over. And there's very little thinking. I mean, it's not even over in the background. It's just like if a thought shows up every now and then, it's a dream type thought, something strange.
I want to invite you to add into this. This is excellent practice. Being aware of just knowing. What I mean by that is, in my experience, there's this embodied vibratory experience. And there may or may not be some kind of commentary. Like, you were saying it's not very often, and it's not very demanding. What else is there?
Well, that's where I went.
I mean, that what I mean by what else is there? There's a zone in there that's
That's where I
not
went.
body,
I know where you're
that's
talking
not
about.
feeling, that's mind.
So after that got really strong. And then it's like it didn't wear off, but I basically just like this super peaceful comfort, like just drop down and said, okay, not like you don't have a thought like that's enough of that, but that just sort of it's like, okay. And I just sunk down into this peaceful place. And then
That's
about,
gladness, that's sukha, gladness.
well, and I don't, minutes, I don't know. I was there for a while. And
Who
then,
cares about the minutes, right? Who cares?
But then it was sort of like that was okay. And then I just like it started like because I had sunk into that long enough, then it the like the cold chill, like super cold chill up and down
That's Petey.
with that, without even forcing it. And then that's about where I was when we that I was just enjoying that. And then that's where we.
When the bell rang.
Is it, we, you know, to go, I've been farther than that, but to do that, it requires more than 30 minutes in the morning and
Oh,
sitting in
yeah.
your vehicle at lunch. And, tonight I take advantage of this. I
Good. That's what
don't,
it's here for.
in the positive way of taking advantage,
You
but
bet.
because you can't, you don't get to do that very often. You don't
Right.
just get to sit for more than an hour or so with just, and true devotion and seclusion seem to be very important. Like
Now,
it's it,
say more about what you mean by devotion.
I don't mean to a deity. I mean true, sincere, heartfelt practice, not just mechanical. I had a stressful day. I need to sit for 30 minutes.
That's
There's very much more to it
that's
to get there.
diligence.
To get in there.
Excuse me. That's diligence. The phrase that keeps repeating over and over again in the Satipatthana Sutta is Atapi Sati Sampajanya. And Atapi is that heartfelt interest, engaged, investigative involvement with what's happening in but in a non-reactive way. And sati is being aware of it. And that's what I was saying, is that There's a more thorough awareness of what mindfulness experience is about when the mind is quiet, when the storyline is off in the other room with the door closed, and there's just this field of sensational experience with no real preference for any part of it. There's just a whole body awareness of it. And then the mind that's aware of that's sati. Sampajanya is clearly knowing it. And that's a tricky part, because the clearly knowing part can either be sort of contaminated with, oh boy, look what I just did, right? Or it can be spaced out, or it can be really, really aware. That's the Sampajanya part. And so I think that's what you were talking about.
The way you're describing that sounds more like the peaceful area of it,
Yeah.
not the real intense. When I first started doing this, I called it the threshold. It was like it's like there's a crossover. Like there's this real intense
It's called
stuff.
access concentration.
Yeah. And once you get on the other side of that, then there's the like places where you
Samadhi
can,
paucity.
you can
Samadhi is
settle.
stability, and paucity is tranquility. And that's associated with sukha, which is this sense of satisfaction, contentment, right? And the piti is that little thrill that might go on. But the piti is just sort of incidental. It's not, it's just there.
Usually, and that's where I don't know. I'm new to this, so I'm basically playing around in it, I guess, if you want to call
Sure,
it that, because
experiment, pay
it comes and
attention.
goes, and you can make it come and go,
Yeah.
and then once it starts waving, you can sort of
Yeah.
like, you can almost will it to go, to do that,
It's not a willing, it's an opening. It's sort of like a door opens and you can fall into the door, right? That's for me, that's what it's like. It's not like I'm making it happen. It's like it's already there and now I'm noticing it. Does that make sense?
Sometimes though I am, once it will do that, I mean the there is a version of a thought going, okay, now do it now. Okay, go up and go down.
That's
There's something
intention.
like that.
That's intention.
Yeah, and that's what I use the word will for, but intention is probably it's softer than will. It's not like I'm going, yeah, look it, I'm doing it. It's not volitional activity.
No, it is volition.
Maybe it is volitional, but not will in a negative sense,
Right.
whatever that means.
It's not gritting your teeth and making it happen. It's being open enough to and sensitive enough, with enough persistence to realize its presence. And you, like I say, you could just, you know, the door's there, you just drop in. So go enjoy your anniversary.
Thanks for the
Hope to see you
talk.
next week.
Yeah, sure.
That's Brandon, by the way. Brandon and I are the only people in the room right now. Well, Brandon's about to leave, so. But we had a very interesting conversation, I think. I'd be interested in what you all think about what I had to say, or your own questions or insights about the Dharma.
John bowing in. I thought it was an interesting conversation you were having with Brandon as well. I couldn't identify with any of it. My experience for 45 minutes was visiting each one of the hindrances and
Shaking hands.
trying to shake hands with them and trying not to fall asleep and to not, stand up and walk away. So I guess I'm at a very basic level, but so and I don't and I don't know. That's all. I mean, that's where I'm at. So I don't understand how. I mean, it must. I assume, the jhanas and all of that. I assume somehow they must help you see impermanence and see not self and see the things that are important to see. Somehow they must be important for all that, or you guys wouldn't be pursuing that, I assume. But for me, it's still I still struggle. I mean, I still need a teacher to tell me, that if I sit in my chair for 45 minutes and don't get up and, and leave the room, it's been a good meditation.
Well, one of my early teachers is Sharon Salzberg, and she said meditation is the art of starting over. And I heard that more than 30 years ago. It's still true for me. I still have to start over. But the starting over is sort of like at a different level of perceptual understanding or sensitivity, that the more we practice, and we have to be diligent about it. One of the problems of regular sitting is what I call cruise control. After a while, your body adapts to the routine, just like it would adapt to, running a couple of miles every day. After a while, you'd do it and you wouldn't even be out of breath. So your body can sit, but is your mind really alert? So you described, dancing with the hindrances. And the more you clearly recognize them and start over, going back to the breath, the longer you will be able to, the more you will understand the nature of dukkha, dissatisfaction, and the more you'll understand how craving and clinging operates in that context. Because craving is what pulls your mind, pulls your mind, pulls your mind. And clinging is what where your mind lands in that, identifies with, this is who I am. And every time you just simply disregard it and go back to the breath, that's letting go of it. And that becomes more and more accessible, more and more workable. You're more proficient at it. And that's what awakening is. It's like waking up from this dream, like you were saying. It's like a dream. But this is something, I don't know you very well, but other people who listen to me talk for years, more practice is necessary. And to begin with, more practice is sort of like, damn it, I got to start over again. But with maturity, the practice is, oh boy, I get to start over again. And that's my I get to start over again happens at a more at a deeper level of sensitivity and effectiveness. Now you've probably heard me say it's like the storyline is like in the other room with the door closed. And I was kind of talking about this a little bit with Brandon, that as this process of letting go back to the breath and kind of dropping deeper into that awareness, that quietness that I kind of mentioned, the doors closed, the voices in the other room, but there's something else going on there that's very interesting. And this is, I think, what he was alluding to, and it's certainly part of my experience. What's happening here? What is this? And that's very interesting for me, that level of practice. But you have to kind of train for it. Just like if you want to run a marathon, you can't just imagine it's going to happen. You have to go out there and, wear out a couple of pair of shoes and work with some aches and pains and all that stuff. Maybe even, do a face plant or two. But you get up and you start running again. But your body adapts and your mind adapts. Learning a long distance isn't just about physical fitness, it's about mental fitness as well. But the same thing with sitting practice. There's a quality of competency in terms of being able to hold a posture. And then the next step is that quietness, opening to that quietness. But when you practice, it becomes something to be interested in rather than something you have to fight for. Does that make a difference? Is that helpful?
Well, what's helpful, what's to me, what's most helpful is the reminder, the pointer that I need to do. I need consistency, because I do run, and I know it is it, consistency is. So that's a really helpful hint, and more practice is necessary. So I just wanted to say something, and I that's it. Thank you. Good to be
Welcome.
here.
You can say more things too when you're ready. April.
Well, it just made me think of something that has always heartened me with Joseph Goldstein's talks, because Joseph Goldstein is, an experienced Dharma teacher, meditator. And even in his later talks, you'll hear him laugh, right? Because he'll say, "There I was, I'd had a good sit before, and then there I was getting annoyed at somebody chanting out of tune or something, and the hindrance coming in." And so that's why they always say that, it's every like Peter was saying, it's beginning anew every time, and every sitting experience is what it is. And even experienced meditators will have, like Joseph Goldstein also talked about how he had like 2 years of the body of light, and then he fought to get back to that state for a while, like a couple more years, and it eluded him because he was chasing it,
Yep.
so.
I had the same experience with Jhana. And I know that story about Joseph Goldstein's experience. And I think he experienced that on a Goenka retreat, if I remember correctly. But he couldn't sustain it. And I had the same kind of experience. I couldn't sustain it either. And this goes to something that you mentioned earlier, John, about Jhana. Jhana is pretty much exclusively a Theravada Buddhist preoccupation. And I'll use that word. It's kind of woven into the fabric of Theravada Buddhism that jhana is extremely important for awakening. But all the other traditions, which are very valid, the Mahayana, the Vajrayana, Zen, they don't emphasize jhana. I think they have those experiences, but it's not become part of, it's not seemed to be necessary. And what Joseph Goldstein was taught and was practices is called dry vipassana. And basically what it means is that you learn how to stay with the process of recognizing what's going on, using breath sensation as a kind of stabilizing point of reference. So it's not like you have to immerse or dive into jhana and into the breath so that jhana occurs. It's more along the lines of breath is, imagine you're walking on a tightrope, and mindfulness of breathing are actually the aspects of mind training that's associated with the Anapanasati Sutta, the 16 stages. It's like a balance pole, balance beam, right? So you don't have to have such rigidly focused attention. It's more that the resources for attention and tranquility and engaged interest, persistent engaged interest, is there regularly. And I've done all of that. And right now, my practice is very similar to what Brandon was describing. I was doing that during this sitting, just kind of opening up to this vibratory field in the body. And it's not like something mystical. It's part of the nervous system. I've actually asked ChatGPT about that, about the body scan, neuroscience, and it said, yeah, these neural connectors and these neural connectors and these neuropeptides. That's what's going on. That's where that body scanning vibratory field comes from. It's not like we're inventing it. We're learning how to discover it and work with it. It's just another tool. So, can you relate to that, Julian? You've had some practice with the body scanning, right?
Hi everyone. Hi Peter. Thank you. Yeah, it's I think what I have heard from the talks is something that just as you say, like the door is open and this openness, and there is something that is still every time has been there, but this when the mind is settled, then you're able to experience it. But actually, it's every time I think happening. What I want to say is along this line of you were telling about Sharon Salzberg and this phrase that the art of starting again. Today I'm following her on the social media, and it's her birthday, and I remember just at the start of the meditation that the first time I had a metta workshop was with you, and you mentioned that you learned these phrases from her.
Yes.
And at that time you said like these are the phrases, but and I think most teachers say like just try to connect with them or otherwise adapt it to what you feel. And when I
Yeah, the
practice
phrase she
metta,
gave me is not the phrase I ended up with. And it took me years to get to the phrase I ended up with. And I'm probably not done with it yet. But there's this, yeah, this quality of informed investigation that's sort of supported by the mantra.
yeah, so when I practice, I'm practicing with a phrase I learned from you, and that has changed from her. And also sometimes I practice in Spanish, and there are some different phrases similar along this, but yeah, the mantras are somehow different, but it's just what you
And I invite you to be really curious about what changes in your experience between using the English version and using the Spanish version. What's different about it? And I'm not saying one's better than the other. It's really an invitation to use this as an opportunity to understand more about the whole issue of loving kindness. Does that
Yeah.
make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. And yeah, I have never thought about being curious about what is different. Yeah, that's something I'll have to look it up. That's interesting, yes. So I was very grateful, like, oh, I learned from you, and you have learned from her and many other teachers. And
Yeah, she was one of my two teachers in my first 3 month retreat also. So I had a lot of experience, well, 5 or 10 minutes every week for 3 months. So I had that kind of experience with her. I very much value it. Very, very kind, heartfelt person.
thank you.
Other questions or comments about anything about Buddhist doctrine? Doesn't have to be necessarily related to your meditation practice. I've done some serious study of the doctrine, and our challenge as English speakers, so to speak, and as contemporary people on the planet, is to understand the basic principles of the doctrine. You know, I've read, I haven't, I'm not fluent in Pali, but I certainly am curious about what a Pali word means psychologically, and then try to figure out how to describe it as a teacher to other people. Partly because it's a translation issue, but it's also an issue that this was, we understand our culture, our education, we bring more to understanding this practice we call Buddhism than was ever possible back then. And I think that enriches it. So if you have any questions about the doctrine, about the concepts, I'd be glad to chat with you about that also while we have the chance. April.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder how you would, I'm interested always, and it keeps coming up for me this topic, where stress reduction mindfulness meets the doors to the path to like a greater understanding of the path. And so we have with the Noble Eightfold Path, we have right concentration. So going back to the jhana conversation, whether we want to call it jhana or we just want to talk about this diligence in training our mind and see, doing seated practice and reaching higher levels of concentration, it seems, that there's something connected with the joys of concentration that aid in, renunciation, essentially, that aid in like all the other factors of the path, like right action, right livelihood, right speech, and good right view, right intention, right understanding. So yeah,
They're all cooperating.
right. So I'm always interested in exploring how we bridge that gap for people who are kind of what John was asking almost, which is like the fruits of those greater levels of concentration, or I don't know if that's the right way to phrase it, but the diligence in the practice of right concentration, sort of feeds back into this ability to get, get the hindrances, taking more of a vacation, right? And enjoying the practice more and more and enjoying this bigger spaciousness of mind, because a lot of the mainstream mindfulness is just so focused on the don't worry about stopping your thoughts and don't worry about, this. But sometimes I feel like it can be misleading, because actually, when you do get into deeper states of concentration, you can experience periods of, either the thoughts are like you were saying in the other room with the door closed, or even actual cessation of thought for a while. And so, yeah, I just wonder your thoughts.
While knowing is still there. There's a difference between thinking and knowing. That's what I was kind of trying to describe to Brandon. Well, jhana is fosters exclusive attention. And in that way, it's kind of rigid. And it takes a lot to develop it. A lot. You have to have a very supportive practice environment. And some people are more capable of getting into it with some degree of facility, while others, it's a real struggle. But the my understanding of the jhana development is that it is so quiet and so stable, particularly at the higher levels of jhana, that the awareness of that creates a whole different perspective on the normal mumble jumble of life. And so it can be quite a shock to go from jhana out into the world. In order to experience jhana, the seven awakening factors have to be operating. But kind of ironically, they are operating, but you can't really be mindful of them. All you're aware of is that quality of attention that we call jhana. With the dry vipassana, the seven awakening factors are there, but they're more, and you've heard me say this before, April, they're more representative of the coherent integration of mindfulness, investigation, energy, tranquility, concentration and equanimity or balance, right? That they are integrated. And so that integration is brought to what I was talking to Brandon about, aware of the body as a body. So like it says in the first foundation, mindfulness. And the feeling tone is pleasant. And what I mean by pleasant, I don't mean physically pleasant. It's sort of like it's interesting. Even if there's physical discomfort, it's interesting. The ability to investigate, it's easier to engage it. And so, and that engagement involves the ability to notice and let go. And that's the energy awakening factor. And so all that is integrated with joy, which is active, engaged interest, and tranquility, which is just a quietness. And concentration is how well they're interacting without any kind of disruption or inequality of their functioning. And that lack of inequality is what equanimity is. But all that's a different way to understand concentration.
Is it right? Is it also like open monitoring awareness? You know, the drive vipassana has that feeling of
Or choiceless awareness, it's called.
exactly, yeah, right. And so it has, as you were describing, this result where you are in this state of equanimity. And so I think back to my question is, for communicating with others, is that, yeah, I really like how you describe the drive vipassana, so that it's like, okay, we have the jhana states and the absorption, the one-pointed absorption, and then we have the drive vipassana. But in both cases, or in I guess more than two cases, there's so many different descriptions of these different states from different traditions. But that, yes, the practitioner over time is experiencing something more than just, you know, the initial mindfulness of, you know, just getting a little break from stress or whatever, right? So, I mean, because the reason I ask this is because sometimes to beginners, I try to explain it in the sense of that you get more and more flexibility of mind and more spaciousness, and that your ability to, like, let's say you're really dealing with the inner critic and you're really suffering, right, from the inner critic, that with practice, with this mindfulness practice, with actual concentration practice, you just develop more and more skill to be able to experience that, notice it, and let go, and then back into more of this equanimous state. And that it's more available, I think, than one would imagine, right? Who's in the early process.
You say it's more available. What's the it?
The freedom. The freedom, the ability to actually get to a point where you're not being dogged as much, right? By
By the
these
hindrances.
yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, that's upachara samadhi, excess concentration. And when I was talking earlier about John's question, with the jhana practice, access concentration means you have access to the jhanas. Access concentration can also mean you can start to develop what you were talking about, which is, and what I was talking about, the unification of the awakening factors. They're more well integrated and coherent, and you know them. You know, you're aware, there's an awareness of how it's working in the same way that you're a musician, April. You know when you're in the groove, right?
Yes, I was just going to
You
say
know
that.
it. You don't have to think about it. You just know it. So that's what that's about. That's what the access concentration is about, and that's what vipassana is knowing that Everything is well integrated in terms of everything, meaning the awakening factors. And it's like learning how to use a tool, like a guitar, to use it skillfully.
And so do you find that sometimes you go into, I don't know, I call it spontaneous. It's not like it's a sudden experience per se, but I will find myself going into long periods of equanimity without having, purposely sat down to sit or something, right? Like, and not even necessarily triggered by a beautiful nature walk, which often does it for me anyway. It is an interesting experience I have where I just notice sometimes, and then I just let it be there. But I will just kind of go into, I mean, blissful is too strong of a word, just because it connotes a feeling of being high. It is more just this equanimous feeling. And then I just like ride it for however long, but
That's
it's
the
just
sukha. That's the sukha.
okay.
You know, the contentment. Is that what you're talking about?
Sounds like it. And I'll just notice it, and then I'll just like ride it for however long. And it could even be on like a in the middle of a work day, and it's cloudy. Like there's nothing special happening. It just happens.
Yeah. A quality of attention that is extraordinary in that regard. You know, the other thing to go back to something I think you were alluding to earlier is a lot of contemporary teachers of mindfulness, it's sort of like a mental health issue. And as a retired mental health professional, I'm well aware of that, right? And it is valuable and it's associated with concentration. It's associated with being aware of distorted thinking processes, and the ability to recognize that they're just something the mind created, like a dream, and that you can let it go. And that's a basic principle of mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. What that does functionally is good. But that's not all there is. And as long as that's understood by the practitioner, it creates you've been on retreats with me, you've heard me talk about a transition from self-state conflict to self-state integration to self-state liberation. So the self-state conflict is when the mind is all jumbled up. And the body is surging with this craving and clinging, right? Self-state integration is when that has been minimized or set aside, minimized in terms of how you move through your day, but set aside more effectively with your practice, that you can get to that zone. And that's self-state integration. And then self-state liberation is what you and I have been talking about, is how do we bring this to society? And when I say you and I, you know, we're not the only people doing this, but we've been talking about it, is that self-state liberation goes beyond just good mental health. Just beyond learning how to manage anxiety, not to get rid of anxiety. You know, when you buy a body, it's hardwired into the nervous system. It's anxiety. We're all affected by it. It's not about that. It's about having a different understanding of it and a different quality of self-regulation in regards to it. So I can be aware that my body is experiencing anxiety, but my mind is not trapped by it, right? Or desire. So I think that that's something that is, I hope, is maturing in the Western world's adaptation to this wisdom from Buddhism and from other traditions that emphasize mental discipline. rather than praying to some deity to make it right, it's training our minds to be more functional in a kind of spiritually liberating way.
Yeah, I think when people talk, I mean, it's kind of gotten trendy in some circles anyway to talk about the non-duality, right? So I think that's maybe one way people are trying to access the
Good.
solution. Yeah, understanding conceptually, it's like it makes me think of a cone, right? Like a cone or whatever. It's like
A koan,
a
AOE.
koan. Yeah, exactly. Like when people start to try to conceptually think about non-duality, it's like they start working on that, right? And then hopefully it leads them to the practices that actually bring about the self-state liberation.
Yeah,
Anyway.
I never was much into koans myself, but that's what they're for, yes, is to kind of shock the mind, surprise the mind in such a way that there's a realization that there really is nobody running the show in here. That it's all made up. For me, it's more along the lines of the mind getting quieter and more open and more spacious, not spacey, but all inclusive, in a very, very quiet, engaged way. And that is what opens up non-duality for me.
Well, yes, and also, it's interesting because I've heard this mentioned a few times. It's going to come up in my talk on the fullness of emptiness, which is that we need the heart practices to go along with the spaciousness. Otherwise, we do kind of get in disassociated, spacey world, right? So having the grounding of the heart practices and compassion with the
And
conversation.
being in the body.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's why I like our tradition. That's why, I like the Theravadin way that we are learning.
I'm also more and more influenced by Tibetan doctrine and not so much the practice. Not so much the sitting practice, but I'm very interested in non-duality from a kind of a Vajrayana Tibetan Buddhist view.
Yeah, I've been learning a little bit about the visualization practices in those traditions too.
Yeah, that doesn't appeal to me much either, but it's obviously very valuable and important for many people. But I think that's one of the things we have the opportunity in this era with the internet. When I first started studying Buddhism back in the early 80s, there were very, very few books, and a lot of them were poor translations of old teachings, and sort of couldn't really understand it because the way that the interpretations, the way the language was presented in these books. But then more and more people like Joseph Goldstein and Larry Rosenberg and these other folks, Sharon Salzberg, started to write. And that really changed things. In fact, the book that really turned me on to the practice was Joseph Goldstein's book, the Well, I can't remember the title of it right now, but the idea is that as the internet developed, now we're open to all these different approaches historically, and also, people like us who are doing this all around the world, trying to come up with a new way of understanding liberation that has some foundation in scientific research and psychology. I think that's very, very interesting. Without disregarding the deep experiential wisdom, particularly of Buddhism, that, diving deep, Buddhism emphasizes how important it is to dive deep. Some aspects of Hindu practices as well, but Buddhism, I think, is remarkable in that regard. I'm enjoying this conversation. Help me out, folks. More questions, more
Me too.
comments.
Thank you. Yeah,
Yeah, Mark.
okay. Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, something April, when April brought up, I'm always curious about the relationship between Vipassana and Samadhi practice, and then there, of course, the Vipassana jhanas, which I know a little bit about. I've never practiced them, but they seem very strange to me. But I
Yeah,
was reading a book.
they are a little strange.
Yeah, I was reading a book a few months ago by Paul Dennison on jhanas, and the second half he had interviews with a lot of jhana teachers, like you had Lee Brazington and Bhante G and Ajahn Brahm and Christine Feldman and Jack Kornfield. They were all over the place, disagreeing. If they were all in the same room, they would have been disagreeing with each other left and right. And one of them, though, was Tanisaro Bhikkhu, who's his meditation, his meditation practice is the one that I primarily follow when I'm sitting. And he does emphasize, what he calls the breath energy, the whole body energization. And his student, Rob Berbea, he passed away in 2020, I think, but his stuff's all on Dharma Seed, and he calls it body energy, but it's the stuff you were talking about of
In the, some traditions they call it banga. It's a whole body
right.
vibration
Yeah. Yeah.
field.
I first heard that term, I think the first time I came here, I heard you mention it. But what was interesting to me in the interview with Tanisaro Bhikkhu was that he said Paul Dennison was asking, he asked each teacher this question, like, what do you think about the balance between, insight practice or Vipassana practice and concentration practice and jhana practice? And he was like, I don't really make any distinction between them at all, and it was because he and Ajahn Brahm is sort of the same opinion. I think that when you get to a very Once you get to the absorptions of the jhanas, insights arise then, or even with access concentration. And so he doesn't place a big emphasis on then doing this practice, for impermanence and for doing specific Vipassana practices
It's
or
not like
doing.
you go into jhana. He didn't say don't have to go into jhana and come back out to do vipassana.
Right. Or like having to like do, like a samadhi practice in the morning and then doing like a Mahasi Sayadaw, like noting practice in the afternoon so that you're covering all your bases. So I was just wondering what you think about the balance between those two, the momentary
I've been
concentration kind of a
exploring for many, many years to find that integration because I've been trained in the Mahasi Sayadaw noting. That was my first several years of my practice. Then I was exposed to the jhana practice and basically Lee Brazington. So I first had it on a Goenka retreat, which they completely disavow jhana. They're not interested in it at all. But going to retreat Lee Brazington, he said, yep, that's jhana. There's all this controversy about light jhana and deep jhana and all that stuff, and I studied with Shaila Catherine in that regard. And she's really masterful at understanding jhana practice. But my exploration has led me to the place where I have different tools that I can be aware of and use. And one of the ways I described it once, well, I've described it more than once actually. It's like if somebody made a comment to me that if you find one tradition and you use it in the same way that you would dig a well to find water. You don't dig holes 5 feet deep all around the area. You dig one hole 50 feet deep, and you'll find water. But my response to that was, okay, I'm going to dig a 50-foot hole, but sometimes I'm going to need a shovel. Sometimes I'm going to need a pickaxe, right? And it's important to know the difference in terms of the material that I'm working with during that sitting, right? And sometimes the sitting is dominated by going deeper and deeper because it just seems like this is where to go. And other times it's like, okay, I get to practice working with a distracted mind and recognizing the instability and impermanence and non-self aspects of a scattered mind. But there's a quality of present awareness that's, like I was saying before, is very stable and workable and insightful, even when the mind is jumping around. However, it takes a lot of practice to be able to understand the difference between just having a scattered mind or doing Vipassana with a scattered mind. And it's very closely associated with what I was talking about with the voice being in the other room with the door closed. There's a quality of attention. It's non-reactive. It's called viraga, which is translated as dispassion. And it basically means that when the mind is presented with a stimulus, there's an awareness of it, but it's non-reactive awareness. So when there's an itch, there's a heightened awareness of the urgency of that feeling. And I'm either going to react to it or not. And I practice with that. In fact, I was practicing with that during this sitting. I practice with that with most sittings these days. There's something about sitting, the way my body is working through this, is that I'll get an itch right around my nose or my upper lip, and it feels like it's burning, right? And the mind really wants to wrestle with it. And I just try to stay present with that without trying to get rid of it and watch it, and then realize after a while, it's dissipating or it's gone away, right? The mind has jumped to something else. And what seems so important about that itch, it's no longer important. Wow, that's really impermanence. That's an example of non-self. And the experience of that urgency is an example of an awareness of craving and clinging, of dukkha. And the dukkha is the physicality of it. And the dukkha is also the story, the self that's created relative to it. And that's a legitimate Vipassana practice. But in order to be able to make that work, you really have to be, Adapi Sati Sampajanya is still there. The quality of diligence and awareness and non-reactivity. Clearly knowing what's going on without reacting to it. Other times, I'll scratch the itch, right? But I'll be aware that this is what my mind is doing. My mind is not working with this exploration of craving and clinging because, all right, I want to get more concentration. The sitting is more about concentration for me. So I scratch the itch and I go back to my routine, my practice routine. But there's an awareness of making that choice. And that's how this works, is figuring out which works for you. And it takes time, Mark. It takes time and practice and a willingness to keep studying what other people have to say about it. And then trying it out and finding what works for you that gets you more integrated and then more awake. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
I just wanted to so Mark, I didn't realize Rob, was it Rob Barbera? How do you say his name?
Verbeya.
And he was a student of Tanisra's.
He was a student of Narayan, Helen Narayan Levinson at Cambridge Insight Meditation Center for 10 years. And then he did, he's English, but he went to music school in Boston. So, and then he started doing lots and lots of intensive retreats with Ajahn Jeff, Dinasura Bhikkhu. And then he was asked to become a teacher, the resident teacher at Gaia House, where he was resident teacher right up until a few months before he died. And all of his retreats and talks from Gaia House are on Dharma Seed. But
And they're very much about non-duality, which is, I mean,
well,
it seems
it's
very
interesting because
Mahayana to me.
Robert Beah taught, he did jhana retreats that are people love, you know. He did a jhana retreat just a few months before he died. He had pancreatic cancer for 5 years. He did an amazing jhana retreat, 3 week jhana retreat at Gaia House just before he died, a few months before he died. He did another one, concentration retreat, jhana retreat, you know, a few years before. But he also did meta retreats, and he did write a book called Seeing That Free, Seeing That
Okay,
Frees,
that's the book. Okay.
which is
We
got
actually
a,
put that
it's
in the
got a
study
chap.
group.
Yeah,
We
it's
used
got
that
a,
book in a
you
study
did?
group.
Oh,
Yeah, we
okay.
did.
So it's got a beautiful chapter on samadhi, which he's taught so many retreats on, but mostly it's, you know, more about fabrication and and non-duality and you know, more, I don't want to say vipassana because his stuff, but yeah, more emptiness and fabrication and not samadhi. But he felt like samadhi was so important for developing insight.
But samadhi can be either understood as one-pointedness, which is the jhana, or non-exclusive openness.
Right. And
All
he,
the conditioning factors, the wholesome conditioning of the factor in the mind, are interacting at their highest level of effectiveness.
and he was much more into openness than you know, hardcore focus. But of course, you can use you know, metta. You can be metta oriented and use that for jhana as well. So,
Well,
but
it's yeah, I just find it really interesting because what you said. So I follow Tanisiro Biko's work a lot, and I've totally read through and listened to his, the breath energy talks and how he talks about jhana and his arguments about, his opinions, right? I love his work. I love him. And so I was curious. So you follow that, you follow his style through Rob Berbea. Do you follow that style of following the breath energy?
I actually was exposed to Rob first, and then Rob kind of modified. Basically, it's the same thing, but Rob has a slightly different approach to it, and he calls it breath energy. But you know, it's clearly he clearly was a student of, as he you know says, of Tanisiro. But Tanisiro's book, I don't even remember the name of his book, where he actually wrote a book on meditation practice. And that's the practice that I primarily follow when I sit. And you start with some metta, and then you do a body scan. He has two or three different ways of doing the body scan. And then he says, you know, then when you finish the body scan, you may be in a position where you're ready to settle down, you know, and then it can be more concentration or more kind of open awareness, depend for me, depending on, you know, what's happening. But I've just found that's,
What book is that, Mark?
it's Tanisiro Bhikkhu's book on his, the book he wrote really on the practice of meditation, which he didn't want to write, he said, and then because his teacher had written a book on it. I can find it.
They're
MIT
pretty
stuff.
much all on his site, dhammatalks.org.
Yeah.
He also has like a beautiful sequence of audio tracks, like explaining all this too and guiding people through this type of practice, because this Thai forest tradition that he followed, this is how they did it, right? This is how he was taught. So,
Yeah.
yeah,
This
it's
one is called With Each and Every Breath. I think
yep.
that's his.
Yeah, you can
Yeah,
get
A
it.
Guide to Meditation. That's the one that he wrote really on how he practices.
Yeah, and you can, Peter, you can download the PDF. You can also write
Yes,
to
I
the
think I might even have it.
Oh, okay. You can also write to the monastery and they'll send you copies in the mail, which I have a whole bookshelf of Tanis Rose
Yeah.
books right over here.
Or they would like a donation, but they don't really charge
Of
it.
course. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they're it works. You send them a letter in the actual snail mail with the books that you want and that they send them to
Yeah. I
you.
download everything EPUB format for a Kobo e-reader, which I have hundreds of Dharma books on my Kobo.
Yeah,
And
lots of
also all of the Ajahn's, like Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Amaro, and all of their books are available for
Yep.
free as well, or for, you know, we
Donation.
give them
I
a
get them
dot
in
on
PDF
donation, but
format.
and they have them in the they have them in Kindle and usually in Kindle format and EPUB format.
Yeah.
But Ajahn Brahm's book is also wonderful on meditation, is wonderful, I think. So
Okay. Thank you.
thank you.
So I very much enjoyed this conversation tonight. We'll be doing it again sometime in the not too distant future. It is our custom at the end of our meeting for us to sit together briefly. So let's do that. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well. I hope you're reasonably safe and happy until the next time we have a chance to chat.